It's Thursday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, British jets bomb Syria following Parliament's vote. The United States and China hold talks on fighting cybercrime.
They've admitted that criminal hackers were involved, and they've said that the state actors weren't involved.
And we hear about country music star Chris Stapleton. It's all ahead. British warplanes have begun carrying out airstrikes in Syria, and this occurs shortly after lawmakers in London approved an expanded strategy to defeat the Islamic State group. I'm joined by VOA Cairo correspondent Heather Murdoch. So, Heather, what is known at the moment about the British mission here of striking targets?
The British say that they successfully struck targets in an oil field near Deir ez-Zor, which is an area, a city, and a province that is controlled by Islamic State militants, or Daesh. They say that the attack was precise and successful, but what exactly that means, we don't know. The British government has also said their aim is to take out targets that will hurt Islamic State militants economically. So if, in fact, they did crush an oil field that the Islamic State was using for revenue, then it would have been quite a success.
So this particular area, now you mentioned basically it's oil fields. Is that the primary function of that area there?
Well, if the attacks were as precise as they say, it would have been an oil field, but they're not. It's not far from a major city. Deir ez-Zor is a big city. I don't think there was any reports coming from there yet, but the thing is news only trickles out of that area because it's so tightly controlled by Islamic State militants.
Is there any word about the U.S. actions within, surrounding that area?
I believe that the U.S. would see the British actions as a success in that the British have been urged by the U.S. regularly to join this battle inside Syria. But so far, as far as I know, the U.S. is continuing with its ongoing operation that's been going on for a while with airstrikes in Syria.
Thank you very much, Heather. That's VOA Cairo correspondent Heather Murdoch.
Thanks.
Well, meanwhile, some crucial details are still being worked out as the U.S. prepares to send a new force of special operators to Iraq, a day after U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced the creation of the Specialized Expeditionary Targeting Force. Military officials said that despite earlier larger estimates, the force would consist of about 100 people with fewer trigger pullers based on the ground in Iraq. Their primary mission will be to find and capture key Islamic State militants to try to get useful information that could lead to additional operations. Well, with a look at what's being said in social media about the British action is my colleague Susan Yockey. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks, Sarah. Online Reuters reports British bombers made their first strikes on Islamic State in Syria today, hitting oil fields that Prime Minister David Cameron says are being used to fund attacks on the West. The four bombers used laser-guided bombs to attack six targets in the Omar oil fields in eastern Syria controlled by the Islamist militant group. Darren O'Toole says, "Sad to hear Britain government voted to bomb Syria. All the advances in the world and people still think war is a solution." Sean Marshall says, "Expensive, get stuck forever, and literally not achieve anything." And Al Arabiya headline reads, "Britain rightly follows France into Syria conflict, reporting, increasingly, the need for the deployment of some kind of ground forces or special forces in eastern Syria is becoming apparent. And the Russian intervention in support of the Syrian regime has at least provided a window of opportunity for all parties involved to negotiate a settlement." In other activity on the web, you probably heard that South Africa's Supreme Court has convicted double amputee athlete Oscar Pistorius of murder, overturning his earlier conviction of culpable homicide, a less serious charge. The court announced its ruling today in the case against the Olympic star, who was convicted last year of the 2013 shooting death of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. On Twitter, Rahan writes, "Well done, justice is finally served." Martin Oliver says, "No get-out-of-jail-free card this time." Mitsala tweets, "I guess episodes of How to Get Away with Murder didn't work for Oscar. Jenny Dobrowskis asks, can we all please forget about Oscar Pistorius and let him get on with his life? And Calling All Astronauts says, whilst I think he murdered her, I find it weird how his sentence has been changed. Sarah?
Thank you, Susan. That's International Edition's Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study from Denmark finds that drinking between 3 and 4 cups of coffee a day can reduce the onset of type 2 diabetes. Researchers from Denmark's Aarhus University Hospital say that two compounds found in coffee, cafestol and caffeic acid, can help prevent diabetes. Scientists had thought that caffeine was the key ingredient that helped avert the now common and increasingly widespread illness. But recent research has shown that caffeine provided only a small effect. People who develop type 2 diabetes have a higher than normal blood glucose or sugar level due to a decreased ability to properly use insulin, a hormone produced by the pancreas that keeps those levels under control. The scientists say that their findings could lead to new medications that prevent and treat diabetes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music star Chris Stapleton gets a fresh look. The United States and China held high-ranking talks this week aimed at furthering cooperation in combating cybercrime. I'm joined now by VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. Bill, so what has been made known about these talks?
Well, we've had statements that have come out at the end of the talks that give us kind of a broad overview of the areas where they're going to try to forge forward and cooperate more, particularly in the area of combating cyber crime. They agreed to hold what's called a tabletop exercise in the spring of next year. And basically that's an exercise that goes through cyber scenarios where you look at how both sides would respond. They made some progress on the establishment of a hotline mechanism, but it's unclear to me, at least, what this actually means, whether they're still not to that where they have the hotline set up. Also, they agreed that they would hold talks, another round of these talks in June of next year in Beijing. But that's what was mentioned in some of the highlights, basic highlights of what was mentioned in the statement. One of the most interesting things, I think, that has come up is that Xinhua has kind of inadvertently mentioned that that China, for the first time, has admitted that it was involved or that Chinese hackers were involved in the attack on the Office of Personnel Management in the United States.
Yes, that has been so controversial here in the U.S. And there have been talks between U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping, I believe, when the Chinese leader visited the U.S. in September about this. I mean, the fact that the Chinese admit to this, how do we go from here as far as the future and to try to prevent future cyber attacks?
Well, I think for starters, what they've done is they've admitted that criminal hackers were involved, and they've said that it state actors weren't involved. So they've kind of tried to distance themselves. I think this possibly creates a little bit of breathing room for the both sides. But one of the key things that was done during these talks this week was individual cases of cyber attacks were discussed. The statements on both sides don't give any details on, which cases were discussed. But I think, the admitting of this will help them to an extent to try to make some progress forward. And it does seem, at least from the statements, that they are making some serious headway towards finding ways to cooperate and better understand one another in an area that has been highly contentious and a serious point of friction between the two countries.
And it also should be noted that the talks were co-chaired by the U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch and Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, along with the Chinese State Councilor Guo Shangkun. I mean, it's very high-level personnel were involved in this.
Yes, very high level. And the fact that, you know, this follows up the state visit by Xi Jinping earlier this year in September, it shows that, you know, the Chinese government is very serious about this. And, you know, in our work on this story, you know, one analyst that we spoke with, was pointing out how what we're seeing happening now highlights how the Chinese government is really trying to, or at least more aware of the sensitivities of the U.S. government and how serious and how big of an issue, you know, this is for the U.S. government. And at least it appears that both sides in China, for its part, is making more of an effort. Now, when it comes to the case of the criminal hackers who are involved, according to China, we also know from the Washington Post that sources involved, you know, with the meetings had told the Washington Post that these hackers actually have already been arrested. But typical to these kinds of things in China, we do not know very little about those who are involved. And because of that, then we do not know whether they have any connections to the government as well. So there's still a lot of questions, but it does appear that, you know, this is there's a lot of focus on this at the highest levels of government in both countries.
All right. Thanks very much, Bill. That is VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, in the Chinese territory of Hong Kong, China is stepping up surveillance of pro-democracy activists there and using methods more sophisticated than ever before. But as Shannon Van Sant reports, it's unclear whether that surveillance is state-sponsored or the work of private individual hackers.
A year after pro-democracy protests filled the streets of Hong Kong, the city has become a target of multiple and sophisticated cyber attacks. Hong Kong's cybersecurity watchdog Hong Kong Computer Emergency Response Team says there has been a 38% rise in hacking attacks since last year. Nicholas Thomas, a professor at the City University of Hong Kong, says it is unclear who is behind these cyber attacks.
There's been no direct on our side, at least on the Hong Kong side, there's been no direct tie with what's going on to the Chinese government or any government agencies. That's possible, of course, but it equally could simply be Chinese hacker groups who are displaying some fairly nationalist tendencies in cyberspace who are doing this under their own steam.
Since August of last year, there have been more than 1,175 phishing attacks where users' data and computers are compromised after clicking on an attachment to an email. But cyber attacks in the city have not been limited to phishing methods. Western security experts say hackers are using more sophisticated techniques, such as Google Drive and Dropbox, to hack into democracy activist devices. Hackers are also using Whitelist, which compromised the data of certain visitors to some websites.
What we do know is it's a pretty sophisticated attack that's taking place. I mean, they're deliberately using Dropbox and also Google Drive to install malware. Or sort of two types of malware, really. And what's going on there is they're using the cloud aspect of Google Drive and Dropbox to mask what they're actually doing.
Victims of the recent spate of cyber attacks include activists, university professors, and journalists. And Western security firms such as FireEye say the sophisticated hacking techniques are commonly used by China and Russia. Tom Grundy, the founder of Hong Kong Free Press, says his website came under attack just before its launch.
It was a DDoS, a denial of service attack, a surge of traffic that seemingly had a human being, you know, behind it. Now, I think we've probably the most secure news website in Hong Kong. So, you know, we recognize vulnerability and others such as Apple Daily, you know, have been attacked a lot more viciously. So we're prepared in some sense for that. But, you know, Hong Kong is meant to be the first and last bastion of freedom of expression and speech and a free press in Greater China. So, you know, a lot of us in the media and beyond are concerned about this.
It is cyber attacks like these that have made Hong Kong the most targeted region in Asia since last year's umbrella movement, according to some security firms. Hong Kong's Democratic Party says it has been the victim of multiple hacking attacks over the last year. For lawmaker Emily Lau, surveillance has become a way of life.
Surveillance, I always feel that I am, even now that I'm talking to you. I think some people know that. And of course, I have nothing to hide. I always say that my life is an open book, and I walk around Hong Kong on my own.
It's an attitude that may be necessary for many of Hong Kong's pro-democracy activists to adopt. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is International Edition. Country music fans have new music to hear from a new star, or is he? VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald is in the studio with International Edition's Jim Stevenson to answer that question.
Chris Stapleton, Jim, is one of these 15-year overnight successes. You know, he comes out of nowhere. You'd never heard of him before, but of course he has a backstory. He is rising in 20th place on the Billboard Hot 100 pop singles chart with a song called Tennessee Whiskey. And his debut album, Traveler, is number one on the pop albums chart for a second straight week. Last week it re-entered at number one. This week it fends off Ellie Goulding, who opens in third place with Delirium. Of course, Ellie is a, you know, pretty good-sized pop star. Traveler debuted on the chart back in May. It opened in second place on the country list, number 14 on the pop list, and then it dropped off the chart entirely in September, and it seemed like Chris would just go on his way. However, on November 4th, Chris Stapleton was the man of the evening at the Country Music Association Awards. He was a big underdog, but he ended up winning Best Male Vocalist, Best New Artist, and Album of the Year. And maybe most importantly, he performed Tennessee Whiskey with Justin Timberlake. And they tore it up. It was a big viral hit. Mm-hmm. And people said, okay, who is this guy? And that's when they started investigating who Chris Stapleton was. Well, he's from Kentucky. He moved to Nashville way back in 2001. He's been in a bluegrass band. He's been in a southern rock band. And then he decided to go solo. So after all that time, earlier this year, he released Traveler. And now he has arrived. And Chris says he has no idea what's next. He says he's just going to keep on doing what he's been doing all this time. He's currently on tour here in the States. And he also has some UK and European dates coming up in March. The United States country music has a very large audience overseas. They love it in Europe. They love it in Australia. It travels well.
Chris Stapleton becoming a crossover star,
yeah,
which really broadens his horizons in so many ways.
It does, and it's significant, too, because what they call bro country has been very popular in the last few years. And these are sort of country rock songs talking about girls and pickup trucks and drinking beer. And they've come in for some abuse at the hands of traditional country fans who say, well, this isn't really country music. But people like Luke Bryan, for instance, are practitioners of this, and they're enormously popular. And the pendulum may be swinging a bit in the other direction. Chris Stapleton, a bit more of a traditionalist. And so it's going to be very interesting if Chris carries some other like-minded artists in his wake. We'll see what happens.
Well, and the country music influence has been around for decades. I mean, we even saw it with bands going as far back as the Beatles being influenced by country music in the United States.
Oh, sure. Country music was there right from the beginning with Elvis Presley and the Sun Records performers. It's part and parcel of what makes rock and roll.
From the beginning and into the future, Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host, and you can also find him on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much for joining us, Ray.
All right, Jim. Thanks.
Tennessee whiskey. Tennessee whiskey. Tennessee whiskey.
That is Chris Stapleton singing about some Tennessee whiskey. Well, that's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Iran, Baha'is, who make up one of the country's largest non-Muslim religious communities, have been a target of persecution by the government for decades, and the persecution continues. Baha'i persons and property are routinely attacked with impunity. Baha'is are denied access to higher education unless they renounce their faith. They are barred from employment in the public sector. They may not inherit property, and they are disproportionately subject to arbitrary arrest. Over 70 Baha'is currently languish in prison because of their religious beliefs. In 2010, the seven leaders of the community were convicted of spurious security-related crimes and sentenced to 20 years, the longest prison sentence given to any prisoner of conscience in Iran. According to recent reports, on November 15th, at least 15 Baha'is were arrested in Tehran, Esfahan, and Mashhad. Reportedly, their families were not informed about their whereabouts or the charges they face. Recent reports also included scores of businesses belonging to Baha'is being shut down in several cities in the Manzandaran province, and authorities closing all Baha'i businesses in the city of Rafsanjan. In its most recent report on the state of religious freedom in Iran, the U.S. State Department noted that the Iranian government discriminates against and creates a threatening atmosphere for all non-Shia, most notably the Baha'is. U.N. Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Iran, Ahmed Shahid, has detailed the abuses suffered by the Baha'i community and urged the Iranian government to end its practice of religious intolerance. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, the freedom to profess and practice one's faith is a birthright of every human being.
Religious minorities, including those who profess no faith, should have the same rights as religious majorities. And that is a fundamental belief.
No nation can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs, said Secretary Kerry. We all have a responsibility to affirm our faith in the principles of religious freedom that the world community has endorsed so many times.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.